You're listening to In the Drink, and I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. You know, I'm excited to share with you this sort of little mini season that we have coming up. It's three great episodes that were mostly taped before the pandemic, and I've been holding on to them since that time because, you know, the world had changed so much since I taped the episodes. And even though we don't have a full season for you, I felt bad hanging on to these interviews because I just think they were so great and the people I spoke with were just so fascinating. So here's the first of the three episodes that we're going to be coming out with for this little mini season. I hope you enjoy it. For today's episode, we have on Michael Schmeltzer, who's the winemaker at Monte Bernardi. His family owns that estate in the heart of Chianti Classico in the town of Panzano. We had such a great conversation. Michael is one of the most knowledgeable people about the Chianti area and truly has a passion for this place. You know, I'll leave the rest for Michael to share with you in this interview. I hope you enjoy it. Can you talk about how you got started making wine in Panzano and Chianti Classico?
I'll try to sum it up. Basically, I got into wine through a passion of cooking, starting from a young age in cooking. That led me to wine experiences in France, meeting winemakers and learning about winemaking in general, and probably questioning my path of cooking at that time. And
you thought you might be a professional chef?
Yeah. That was my first passion. So I worked in restaurants, you know, started from dishwasher, prep cook, line cook, all the way up, and then went to Le Cordon Bleu, did the full cuisine and pastry degree, and we could take an elective to travel every other weekend to a different region and meet winemakers. And actually, my first winemaker I remember meeting was Jackie Blow.
Oh, wow. In Loire Valley.
Yeah. And that was a really impressionable visit. And, you know, that was in the 90s. And I just remember learning about, like, fruit spectrums and soils and how they impacted, like, how wine would taste. And I was just completely hooked from learning all these things. And I finished my undergrad at Boulder. I finished my grand diploma at Le Cordon Bleu. And I was like, I know what I want to do. And I, like, dropped everything and went to study winemaking viticulture.
Wow. Just to back up a little bit, you grew up here in the States?
Yeah, a large part of it. I was born in Italy, then we moved to France, and then Michigan for a good 10 years. Then I finished high school in an international school in Germany. Mm-hmm. And that's where I started cooking restaurants. Well, cooking, you know, prepping and stuff like that. And
was it just a side job at first, or is it a passion?
It was a passion from very early age, like 11 years old kind of thing, you know, where I would go and pass out flyers so the local bread guy would teach me how to make bread and things like that, you know, that kind of a crazy thing. And then remembering really great experiences and reinforcements, like first thing I baked out of a cookbook was Sally Lund bread from James Beard Cookbook, and remembering how much my family loved that and just built on that. And it's, I think with cooking, as I did more and more and studied more, the passion for learning about it didn't go away, but I think I saw the passion for wanting to do it as a profession less attractive, I guess. And so wine came in at the right time, I would say, and I've never looked back.
I had a somewhat of a similar experience, though I think much more condensed on the cooking side. I realized that after my first cooking job that wasn't what I wanted to do, no matter how much I loved food. But something that you said kind of reminds me of my experience, because I realized that when you're in a professional kitchen, you don't get any feedback unless something's wrong.
That's
right.
True.
Unless something's overcooked or undercooked or oversalted or undersalted or whatever it
Absolutely.
Is. But you're saying about how much you loved baking this thing out of the book and then sharing it with your family and getting that feedback. I wonder if that sort of like disconnect from the guests was maybe one of the things that you didn't like
about. I never had a desire to be front of house. So that probably didn't go that far. But I think I thought about it. You know, you spend a lot of time creating a dish, and it might be something that people really enjoy, but, you know, in the end, it probably, you don't get that feedback. And I'm sure there was something to that as well, but I felt like it was killing my passion to want to do it at home, mm-hmm. I think. And I think that was probably a bigger part of it, but really the agricultural side of wine probably attracted me to winemaking more than I could have ever imagined, really. And when I studied, I took all the classes for viticulture and winemaking that I could. And
what was available to you?
I studied at Adelaide University in Australia. Wasn't my first choice, but I'm very happy it ended up that way. I actually tried to go to UC Davis, but they wanted me to do a lot of prereqs as a second degree student. And so
I have like a scientific background.
Yeah, they wanted to do they were like, you're missing all these sciences to do it as a second degree student. And so like, I'm not trying to be a doctor here. So I looked up, my alternatives and Adelaide was such a highly regarded program. And so I went out to Adelaide and it was just an unbelievable experience all around. And I don't think I would have gotten the viticultural side at Davis. I would have probably done winemaking and been more lab focused and science focused. And so I feel very grateful that it happened that way. And of course, I met fantastic people out there as well. But the agricultural part really grabbed me. And when I was there, I started going to Central Market in Adelaide, which is like one of the most amazing open food markets in the world that I've experienced. And I was buying organic stuff. And over time, I started buying biodynamic things, but didn't really know what it was. And then I became convinced it was better than organic things. And so I started, like orange juice that tasted of minerals and not just sweet and sugar and acid and water and eggs that, that were just a whole, like eggs that I remembered from France. And so I started looking into biodynamic wine producers and found out that there were quite a few that were biodynamic, but they didn't really advertise it. It was kind of still considered just organics in general was really, that was a period when organics was really looked on negatively, like the really poor American organic wines that used to be on the shelves with no sulfites and were like tasted like vinegar and things like that. And people didn't want to even have organic on the label back then. So
they were afraid people would look at them negatively. It's amazing to me that there was a robust biodynamic produce population, yeah, that you could find biodynamic orange juice and eggs.
It was I don't know how large it was, but certainly there were standout producers of biodynamic things in Australia back then. And when I found these producers, one of them, Julian Castagna of Castagna Vineyards in Beechworth, convinced me to join the Biodynamics Association of Australia. And then I started getting into that, doing their like courses and things like that.
Was there information available at Adelaide as well, or you had to go outside to
Adelaide? In my degree, we spent one day on organics and the whole program back then. I would imagine it's different now, but back then it was like that. And back then it was possible to study viticulture and winemaking at the same time. But now I think it's harder. They've shortened a degree a year from what I understand. But we also had like the greats, Patrick Island, Peter Coombe, the guys who wrote a lot of the books on viticulture and winemaking. And just, it was a fantastic time to be in Adelaide. But when I moved there, I love the kind of rich and varietal wines that were being made there. And it really helped my understanding of wines. But after tasting and drinking them for 4 years, my palate started to change and I started to seek out wines that were less obvious and over the top sometimes and more subtle, more food friendly. And so before I even left Australia, I had a very strong idea of what I wanted to do when I was taking over Montebernardi, our family estate. And that was to do biodynamics and to peel back all the layers of kind of modern winemaking and viticulture. So,
did you leave Australia in order to take over Montebernardi, or was there something in between?
No, I actually wanted to do more experiences in Australia, but we made a family decision to buy Montebernardi. It was my sister's suggestion to my parents that if they retired on a property with vineyards, me studying winemaking viticulture, and her wanting to leave her job at Price Waterhouse in Berlin, that we could make a business out of it. And so that was kind of the start of it. And we looked in France and Italy when we saw Montefinardi, we were all convinced that it was the place. For me, it was quality potential. I still look at Chianti Classico as undervalued. And, you know, to me, it's Grand Cru, very special area. But I was very attracted to the potential of that undervalued region. And for my sister and my mother, it was more about lifestyle and a proximity to cities and things like that. So it kind of had that aspect to it.
And how do you find the property? Was it a long search? Did you consider other regions?
We looked in a lot of regions for sure, even in south of France. I actually probably, you know, because of my French cooking experience with Le Cordon Bleu, there was strong desire to also look heavily into France. And we did. But I don't think we found opportunity. Most of the opportunities we saw were like massive estates in the south of France. And they're like, yeah, the TGV is going to go through this vineyard in, you know, in the next 2 years, they're going to build the track. And it's like, oh, great, machine harvesting, you know, but nothing with quality potential that I was interested, except maybe I saw some really cool things in the Pyrenees, but I'd be making Cremant, and which I was totally into. But my mom and my sister were like, no, like no chance. We're not living out here. So how we found it is Sean O'Callaghan from Riachine. I had met him, and he was also an inspiration to me going into winemaking, because I had met him in the late 90s at a birthday party in Gaioli at Riachine. And I was like, whoa, here's an Englishman making wine in Chianti Classico. And I was like, hey, you don't have to be born into this kind of thing. And that was kind of something that just didn't occur to me when I was meeting people like Jackie Blow and stuff. And so that was an important step as well. And so when we said we were looking, he's like, you got to see Montefinardi. And Montefinardi was a really complex situation. It was a bad divorce, and neither of them wanted to leave the property. They wanted to keep ownership, and he wanted to keep the wine side going, and so he was sabotaging a lot of the prospective buyers, and she was going her own route. And so it took a long time to get across the line, but we were successful and very fortunate.
Wow. What were those early years like? You said you knew you wanted to go to grow biodynamically. Was there a good foundation there? Was there a lot of work that had to be done?
I had the theory in my head, and I had the viticulture theory from school, but I had never practiced it in any real way. So I took it. I was fortunate to have, you know, someone who had been farming and working on the property for a while, and his partner also was working, you know, part-time. So I relied on them heavily for the basics and to understand. And then I slowly integrated things over time that I wanted to try to do. And as I talked to more older people about why they didn't do things anymore that I heard about, we slowly integrated those things back into Montefinardi, because I saw the value in them, you know, like wrapping the shoots along the top wire, which we call it braiding. That's a fundamental thing that we've done from the beginning that's really important to the way our wines are, you know, end up in the bottle. You know, it's a really important thing that's kind of taken for granted and often not done anymore.
So, what does it do?
So most people, when the shoots go above the top wire, they hedge trim, you know, and hedge trimming takes the tip off where all the new growth comes off out of. And so a vine being a climber thinks it's lost its ability to climb. It'll shoot out the side shoots, what we call the laterals or the femminelli. And that will throw off the balance of your canopy. You will lose your light inception, your aeration in the canopy, and make it harder to farm organically, biodynamically, and your bunches will become too shaded. So you'll have to come through and shoot thin and leaf pluck. But I knew that from university, so I wanted to bring back the wrapping. But what I realized after several years of doing it at Montefinardi is we got a bigger advantage, which was all that wasted energy on the canopy slowed the shift from vegetation to moving over to the bunch. And so by wrapping, my vines would switch over to the bunch sooner. So I would maintain more acidity. be able to pick with lower sugars and get higher quality tannins. So that over time allowed me to do longer post-maceration. It allowed me to use all the pressings and things like that. So a very, very important part that most people take for granted. Modern producers would say, oh, but they didn't, old farmers didn't do a cut because they didn't have the ability to cut them all at the same time, you know, or whatever, with a machine. But the reality is, if you ask an old farmer why they didn't cut, they'd say, well, then the bunches wouldn't ripen, you know? So they knew, you know, I think for them, it was more obvious because they had harder times ripening grapes back then. Mm-hmm. But that's a really important thing. The right rootstock is extremely important. Most people in our region use the wrong rootstock. It worked for decades, but it was never the right rootstock. If you look at it on paper, it says, doesn't like waterlogging, doesn't like heat stress, doesn't like calcareous soils, you know? So when I was starting to plant our first vineyards, I asked people around, why are you planting on this rootstock? It makes no sense. Doesn't go deep, doesn't like calcareous soils, mm-hmm. doesn't handle heat stress well, doesn't handle water. They're like, stai tranquille, Michael. We all do, you know, we've all been using it for all this time. And so I just ignored that advice, basically, and planted mine all with deeper rootstock because I had the viticultural background and it just didn't make sense. I said, if I end up having too much vigor, I'll have more permanent grass. I'll use cover crops. I'll do, you know, manage my canopy different. But in reality, they're absolutely perfect. You know, even from a young age, they have so much more balance than those.
Biodynamic viticulture also sort of requires you have more cover crop anyway. So it sort of creates that natural balance in that way.
Yeah. And that, I think the previous owner always claimed to be organic, and I think he avoided non-organic sprays, but he was missing out, I think, on that aspect. And it's easy for me to see a big difference over the years of how much our soils change, how much our vines became more balanced and things, you know, the quality of our grapes and things like that. But I say we farm biodynamically, but in reality, I think a better description of what we do is old farming practices. You know, if I ask an old farmer if they use stinging nettle or chamomile or something, they'll say, oh, yeah, we used to do that. So why don't you do that anymore? Oh, because we could buy a tub in the Consorzio Agraria that seemed to work just as well. You know, the problem for me with biodynamics after experiencing it and trying it for years was that it didn't mesh with the practicality of an old farmer. An old farmer didn't have luxury of saying, I'm not going to do this on a fruit or a flower day or a root or a leaf day. It's ignorant to think that they had that kind of luxury if you know the sharecropping era, the history of our area. In fact, you know, I use it as a gut check. So like, well, I think, you know, biodynamics was a launching pad for the way I think about how we grow our grapes and make our wine. And I do use it to describe what we do because it's easy to digest and understand kind of our general philosophy, but a better description would be old farming practices.
Yeah, I always wonder about biodynamics that maybe it could be a little formulaic too, that what works in Austria maybe doesn't work in Chianti.
Absolutely.
Even though many of my favorite wines are biodynamic. When was that change from the sort of logical traditional viticulture to commercial industrial viticulture in Chianti? And, you know, do you look at a farmer and see they're in their 60s, like, oh, a little too young. He's not really, they're not really going to have good information.
It's pretty easy to see that transition because if you go further back than the 60s, no one making wine today in my region was there, you know? So all the pretty much every winery in our areas, very few of them were making wine before the 60s. It was the sharecropping contadini. And, you know, they went from one job to the next and they wrapped their shoots. They tied with the shoot of the willow tree. You know, they burned their pole tips before putting them in the ground and farmed inherently for the most part organically. They might have used like PK phosphate little things, but for the most part, they were inherently organic because it was cheaper and it was what they always did, you know, copper and sulfur. But when the landowners who had, so Montepinari was one of 13 properties owned by the Bonsegni family, when the sharecropping era ended, they started selling off the individual properties. And
78 or so.
Yeah, even before I think started, you know, there are some farms that were bought in the 60s of people we know and respect today. And so, but larger amounts were probably in the 80s and early 90s. And the people who came were largely Italian. I mean, some were English, American, you know, German, but most of them, if not all of them, didn't come from agricultural backgrounds. You know, they came from other settori, as we say, accounting, lawyers, you know, all different backgrounds, but not agricultural. And so to me, that's where the transition started. And younger generations of the old contadino often left the area. Maybe they didn't want to work for even the counts or the dukes when they were hiring people, as opposed to the sharecropping agreement. But a lot of them left the area, so a lot of the knowledge left the area as well. And, you know, the chemical companies came in and started proposing things that seemed to be easier and faster and things like that.
Probably seemed like progress in a way to them, seemed modern.
Yeah.
I love this idea that you're an outsider, or maybe we're an outsider. And
still an outsider. Maybe more so now than ever.
And you're bringing back these old traditions, these like truly Chianti traditions that the people who maybe who've been grew up there or making wine there are not using anymore. And they're sort of doing these modern techniques that could be found anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you're thinking that that helps to make the most Italian or the most Chianti tasting wine
in a way. I do. And I think, you know, I have the same desire as, you know, other producers to make wines that people enjoy. And, but as I said, from my experience in Australia, I had a desire to find ways to achieve my goals without products, without fining, without filtration, using native yeasts. Because to me, from the experience of Australia, every time you use a product or technology, you're kind of like shaving away a layer of typicity from your wine. So I definitely learned a lot over the years and started doing things that I didn't do in the beginning, but the goal was there from day one, what I wanted to do. And I bought Botti Grande from day one. And I was very passionate about wine, and so I tasted wines from all over, and they influenced me, you know, like big barrel wines from even the Mosel, or big barrel wines from Nebbiolo producers in Barolo and Barbaresco, and even Montalcino, you know. But my favorite wines from Montalcino that actually had freshness and elegance were usually aged in Botti Grande. Mm-hmm.
So, what were some of the Sangiovese-based wines that sort of inspired you?
I've said this before, but La Bonci is one of my absolute favorites, Le Trame. One, because I love the person behind it, but also the generous, you know, she's such a generous person, and I did learn a lot from her. But I love her wines every year, you know. I think she's so honest about them, and even when she has problems, she's very honest about them, and I think they're just wonderful wines. And
it's Giovanna Morganti.
Giovanna Morganti, yeah.
And she does sort of bush-trained vines, if I remember, right?
Yeah,
like, they're not trained on wires.
Yeah, which makes more sense for her than it does for me. She's in a warmer area. I don't yet. Maybe in the future, I'll have to consider it. But right now, I get often asked how much climate change is affecting us. And it definitely affects us. We get more intense, like torrential rainfalls that are taking away our topsoil and speeding up the ripening of our grapes just because we don't have that much cloud cover and slow rainy days. But I feel extremely lucky that for the most part, our last 6 weeks of ripening tend to cool down quite a bit. And being in the center of Chianti Classico, we're protected from the increased cases of hailstorms and things like that.
Some of the ones I've had in Panzano, though, can be quite ripe and intense and structured and powerful. Yeah. I think of yours as more on the elegant and nuanced.
Yeah,
is that a winemaking decision or a picking decision or where you are?
Yeah, for me, it's, I think, largely philosophy differences. You know, I don't green prune, I don't table sort, I don't use products, I don't fine, I don't filter, I don't use non-traditional grape varieties. my model is not, to lack of a better description, the 100-point measuring stick. And I think if you follow that road, you make a lot of decisions to move your wines in that direction. And as a, personally, as a producer, I think it's a mistake. And I hope younger generations realize this, that to me, selling with high points is the same thing as selling with low prices. You sell more when you have them, but you don't gain loyalty. So I've always taken a different approach. And fortunately, my wine style probably wouldn't have done well in that direction anyway. But if I were trying to go that path, I would probably feel more pressure to change things that we do. But it goes back to that kind of shaving away layers of typicity, is that when you make those decisions, to me, you actually make your wines more homogenized and less distinct. And so you actually compete with more of Tuscany. And so by doing what I do, I feel like I represent the place more typically, let's say, traditionally. And so I actually feel like I have less competition. You can compare us to less producers.
I've always felt that at a higher level of alcohol, you start just tasting much more fruit. And especially if it's aged in oak, then it'll extract more oak. And at that point, it starts to lose typicity because you just taste like fruit. Flavors can be replicated, I think. But those terroir flavors are so specific.
Exactly.
And they really exist. I know most of your wines are below 14. They're like 13.
Yeah, they usually land around. I've never used an analysis to decide to pick. And so it's quite funny that they usually land on 13 and a half, like they could be a degree under or a degree over. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was really important to develop that instinct, because I knew that relying on a number, you're more likely to make a mistake than you are to do something good for your wine. So, I think that like things like wrapping the shoots is a big part of why we're able to pick with the lower sugars and the higher acids and things like that, because we're able to pick with the higher quality tannins.
I know you said you're quite friendly with Giovanna Morganti from Le Bonchier. Were you and your family welcomed, embraced when you first got there? Was it hard to form relationships?
I definitely felt embraced because I think it's such a social industry. I blame myself a lot about how rigid I was when I arrived. But, you know, I was a young 20-ish person and I felt a lot of stuff on my shoulders. And my way would be to just kind of be overly serious, probably. And I kind of regret that in a way, but I think that's just my character. And I'm so much more relaxed and enjoy being there. But I feel like I probably, you know, set myself up to be less approachable in a lot of ways. But that's just, I think I am a farmer at heart in a lot of ways, a country bumpkin almost. And so it's kind of harder for me to be outgoing and things like that. But I have such a love and passion for our region. And I get really frustrated when I see decisions being made to move it in the wrong direction, you know,
because sort of decisions.
Decisions like we've recently had more problems. The way reservas in Chianti Classico have been passed by the Consorzio and Valore Italia is changing. Around 2015, they started changing the rules of how a Chianti Classico should taste and be reflected in the bottle. And so starting with our 2016 reservas and consistently every wine we've showed since, we're getting feedback that our wines are now lacking in intensity. So meaning color and like richness, and I've been told that they think the wine should be more supple and rounded. And my response is that that's moving the wines to the center, more homogenized, and making our wines less distinct to the rest of Tuscany. I think it's a very big mistake. So I get extremely frustrated with that.
So I know they've denied you the Chianti Classico Reserva appellation.
Yeah, they rejected the first wine I presented. It was partly my fault that I didn't realize what was going on. You present the wine, and they sample it, analyze it, and taste it in a tasting panel. And if it rejects you know, they say they want to see it again, you can present it again. And it's happened to me before. And, you know, we don't sulfur until we pre-bottle. And so when my wines are sampled, they have zero free sulfur. And they have some total sulfur, but they have zero free sulfur. And so I usually just make my pre-bottling addition, resubmit it, and it passed always in the past. I mean,
the rare occasion. Also fixes the color, right?
It actually initially probably lightens the color, but it just stabilizes the wine. It tightens it up so it's less, you know, sometimes they think the wine is too evolved because it has no sulfur in it, but it's not about that. So I presented the 16 the second time without thinking about it, and then it got rejected, and it said it was non idonea.
What does that
mean? Not identifiably Chianti Classico Reserva, essentially. And then we presented the site to 16 shortly after. They also wanted to see it again. And I was like, wait a second, what's going on here? And then I started to go down a rabbit hole of these changes and these ideas and talk to everyone I could possibly talk to. And they're saying, Michael, your wines are rough when they're sampled. You know, they have rough tannins, ruvido. Why don't you find the wines with potato and soften them? You know, I was like, I haven't added anything to my wine in 17 years. I'm not going to start now. How about we reteach the tasters how Sangiovese evolves in a bottle? Because when my wines are released, it's very rare that someone would call my wines rough or ruvido. They're quite elegant. It bothers me as a producer of our wines and doing it what we're doing. But to me, the bigger problem is for the denomination, because we're erasing what makes our denomination special. And it started with the Gran Selezione, which to me is a super Tuscan within our denomination, and I was fine with that, but now it's creeping down like a fungus and taking over Reserva, and so now I have no choice but to be against both changes. So now,
and I imagine a less scrupulous producer, but maybe one who doesn't care as much, might go back to the lab and say, how can we adjust this so that we pass?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, the job of the winemaking consultant is to move you towards the higher scale of the 100-point score. And that goes hand in hand with the styles that they're promoting in this direction. And if they want to make those wines and they think that's the way to go, you know, I think that should be their prerogative, and it probably makes our region larger appealing to have different styles, but to internally try to prevent producers like me from making our wines in a more traditional way that is lighter in color, not supple and not high in alcohol or whatever, is to me a big mistake. It's shooting themselves in the foot, and is going to have people stop buying Chianti Classico if that continues in that direction, or Reservas.
I mean, I could understand why Giovanna Morganti, for instance, dropped out of the appellation. Or I'd imagine you really like Montevertine wines.
Yes, which I do. Absolutely.
Sangiovese, that's so elegant and pure. And they don't make a wine in the appellation for years.
Do. They don't anymore. I mean, for years. And Giovanna's more recent defector, but it's now going on quite a few years now.
Have you thought of dropping out
of the
appellation?
Yeah, well, that's what my friends suggest to me. And they're like, oh, denominations are dead, you know, and these are Italians from great restaurants saying, just leave. And it's like, I came here to make Chianti Classico. You know, we have such a special history and culture of making the same grape year in and year out. And this is how I describe it. I say, we're an area that makes cucina povera food and wine, and we should embrace that. You know, to me, the modern style is like trying to make filet mignon. It's like ignoring the past. And I want to make the slow cooked rustic soul food.
The Lampredotto.
Yeah. Or the Poposo, or the, like something that uses the offcuts, but is done with care and knowledge of the past in a thoughtful way. And to me, that is more soulful.
That's sort of the identity, really. It seems like that's what you're looking for there.
Because filet mignon can be made anywhere. You know, but I joke.
It could taste good anywhere, but it's not. It's never going to give you that kind of connected experience.
No, exactly. And every bite's the same, sort of, in a way.
Yeah,
you know?
It's not a bone and ribeye.
No.
Or Bistecca Fiorentina, I guess, is more appropriate.
Exactly. And ironically, so Dario Cecchini in his Netflix and Chef's Table was like, I didn't have a bistecca until I was 21. And then it was a big disappointment, you know, and that kind of resonated with me. I'm like, you know, he realizes how these offcuts made the right way are so much more special than something like the bistecca. And to me, we haven't gotten that understanding in the wine side. You know, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. We need to appreciate how special the Cucina Povera wine side is, in a sense, and embrace that and bring it back. And that's, I guess, what I'm trying to do.
And older, I don't know if this is Cucina Povera or Vino Povero, but the wine that you make is in the old Fiasco.
Yes, yeah, we make as well, yeah.
Can you tell us about how that came about? Because I had never seen a wine in a Fiasco that I was excited to drink before, but yours is delicious.
That I can't take credit for the idea or the wine directly, because we don't grow the grapes for that wine. That was Jamie Wolf of Chamber Street Wine who said, I want to bring back good wine in the Fiasco. So, and I don't know how long ago that was. It's at least 5 years ago. And so I said, yes. My sister said, no. I was like, no, don't do that. That's not good for our image. But I'm glad we did it. So we started doing it for him. And then people just kept asking us to kind of make it more available for other people.
How fun. In the wicker. Yeah. And where do you source the grapes for that?
That's from Montaglione Chianti. High altitude, galestro soils, organic farming. But it's a bit more robust and intense than where we make our Sangiovese, you know. So to me, it's the perfect Fiasco wine.
I think I know the answer to this, but as someone who's somewhat of a scholar of old style, old school Chianti, did you ever think about making a wine with Governo?
I think it would be more appropriate if I had problems ripening our grapes. But I don't think that will be necessary the foreseeable future. But I have thought about pergola, for example, like self-shading and things like that. I've thought about, like, you know, that maybe we'll have to go back to something like that.
As the sun gets more intense and it's warmer. Exactly. Yeah. All the 90s, everyone was getting rid of the leaf cover and getting more ripeness on the grapes.
My ideal canopy is dapple light of splotches of shade, splotches of light. Too much sun, overripe, lower acid, and too much shading, herbaceous, green. So you really want to find that balance. And by not hedge trimming, it's much easier to get that balance naturally. But the fundamental thing is starting with the right rootstock. That's so important, because if you don't start with the right rootstock, they go into heat stress. The first leaves they drop are the ones that are over the bunches, the basal leaves. So then you expose your bunches and get burning if it's later in the season, or just get overexposure, jammy, kind of lower acid.
You mentioned the desire for people to make these sort of bigger 100-point wines multiple times. And I guess I was a little surprised to hear that it's still going on, that people still care that much about them. And I wonder if there's a group of like-minded producers that you have. Is there a new wave of people who are taking a similar approach to you?
So I think Rada understands their assets better than Panzano at the moment. A lot of those producers are doing a better job of bringing out the best of their area and not going so much, you know, like Roberto Bianchi. And, you know, there's so many good producers in that area, Paolo Carparsa. And I think they understand the assets better. So I kind of think it's a little bit of an age thing as well. I think it's hard to break away from that way of selling your wines when you start that way. I think it influences who ends up being your importer, what channels your wine gets sold through. And it's kind of something that's really hard to break away from once you go down that path. And then the dark side just keeps calling you and calling you back. And I think there was like 3 years where a lot of people were making super delicious Sangioveses because they stopped using non-traditional varieties. They're using a lot less barrique and starting to produce just unbelievable wines. But then I think the dark side started calling them back again.
Wow.
And then because they, you know, how do you give a wine with less color and, you know, less ripeness 100 points without sending an encyclopedia explaining every wine in that rating guide, you know?
It's almost like they think that Burgundy is the only place in the world that can make wines of like depth and intensity without a lot of color and weight. Yeah.
But do they get 100 points sometimes?
I don't know.
Maybe they do. They probably do. And it is, I see some more of those kind of scores coming out, but they're usually with a qualifier. You know, they're like, this is a, you know, old school, traditional, rustic, you know, thing. And it'll give a higher score that they would have never gotten 5 years ago. You know,
have this before you drink your scarecrow or whatever.
But I like what Eric Asimov does. You know, he like doesn't do points. He just lists great producers at the end of the article. Then he actually tries to teach people doing the wine classes online, which is just blows my mind that he tries to do it like that. It's amazing. To me, that's the like the model of how to like introduce people to new wine, because you need the educational part. Yeah, otherwise, a 96 point score is a 96 point score. You have to kind of, the wine has to mold itself to the 96 or and above. Whereas if you do it without scores and you highlight good producers who are doing the right thing, and then you follow it up with the education, it's the perfect way.
He's a great writer.
Yeah, he's
the tastings, the line tastings, I've done a few of them with him. They're truly blind. Like, he doesn't even know the producers that are going to be and a lot of times he's like, oh, I wish we could have included this producer, but like, it's truly blind, and there's always a few surprises. A last kind of technical question, you know, you've mentioned Panzano and Rada. I wonder if you think that there should be more labeling clarity on bottles so people sort of understand what area of Chianti Classico.
Absolutely.
And we're just talking about Chianti Classico, really, you know, something comes from, because it's a little bit of a bigger region, I think, than people expect or understand. And it's so diverse from north to south.
I'm a big proponent of subzones. I've talked about it a lot in over the last, I don't know, 5+ years. To me, that is super important. Is what I try to explain to people is, if we all sell it as Chianti Classicos, then we have a very small market. And the easiest way to illustrate this is, if you go into a wine shop, they'll be like, oh, I have 2-3 Chianti Classicos already. I can't, you know, have more. But if he's selling them by Panzano and Chianti, Gaiolo and Chianti, Castellin and Chianti, you know, we've just tripled our, you know, shelf space as a region by going subzone. The problem is that they're ready to do it, but they want to start with Gran Selezione, which to me is the least subzone reflective wines that we make. So it doesn't really follow through with the concept very well. And who knows when it will arrive to the base, as we call them. And who knows if Reserva will be Reserva anymore, or just baby Gran Selezione.
I know how you feel about Gran Selezione at this point, but I wonder if they had an opportunity to make Gran Selezione something really good and important, just kind of missed by not making the standards high enough. Or
you're very generous.
I don't think we need a Grand
Reserva category. Yeah. We'd never needed one. But my sense is it was necessary to bring back large producers to the region, and they needed more tiers to fit their wines in, because their IGT versions weren't selling anymore, didn't have the power in the market that they used to. Now that they're back in, I think they're trying to indirectly or directly change us back to Super Tuscans, and the market's saying no. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty saying yes, but I think they should learn from that example and say, you know what, this region is special enough to not homogenize it and move it towards the center.
And so what's the future for Monte Bernardi? What are you working on right now? Are you
going
to do
this? Very exciting times now. My father wanted to sell his ownership out of Monte Bernardi when my mother died, and he remarried, and life changes made him want to change what they wanted to do with the rest of their lives. And so we found an amazing family to join us and take over his part, the Bedfords. They're lovely, lovely people. And it's allowed me to continue my kind of vision of Monte Bernardi and grow Monte Bernardi for the first time in a long time. So we just bought, at the end of 2018, 10 more hectares in Panzano above the town, like some of the most sought after vineyards in Panzano, with the bulk of them over around 15 years old.
You're talking about like 500 meters somewhere in that
5'10".
Height? 5'10".
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Perfect placement, great soils, right rootstocks. And then there's a hectare of 1933 Chianti Classico, field blended with like Calabrese, Chilajolo, Malvasia Bianca, Canaiolo Bianco. So that's super exciting. And then we have to convert those into organics and biodynamics. So for at least 3 years, they'll go in our own bottlings. But in the long term, my plan would be to incorporate some of it into Retromarcha, and then we'll see.
How cool.
So that's very exciting.
It'd be fun to do one bottling just from that old vineyard.
Oh, that's already there? It's already there. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It's in the tank. Yeah.
How special.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much. This has been such an enlightening conversation.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of In the Drink. I loved having on Michael Schmelzer of Monte Bernardi. Now, we have two more special episodes coming up that have been pre-taped. I hope you listen in and enjoy them, and we'll keep you posted on when our next full season is coming out. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Doing those three things really helps us and helps other people to find these interviews that we put so much effort into, and I'd really appreciate it. If you have any questions, comments, or just want to share a great wine that you drank recently, feel free to send us an email at inthedrinkpod@gmail.com. Also, follow us on Instagram at Joe Campanelli. I want to give a big thanks to Jessamine Molly, who's our producer, and she has a great production company called Seaplane Armada. You can also follow them on Instagram at Seaplane Armada. Thanks again so much for listening. This has been another episode of In the Drink.